All right, episode 4 today. Welcome, everyone, to another chat with Ryan Squared, Ryan and Ryan, however you want to put it. I think last episode, someone thought at the beginning that I was talking to myself because I was like, oh, Ryan is doing this and this, and then they're like, who's he talking to, if they didn't know that there was another Ryan on the end of the line? But
do we need to do like Ryan K and Ryan D? Do we need to be like first grade where we have those little name tags on our desks?
Well, I guess we could do RK and RD or something, but...
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. So today we are going to catch up on a whole bunch of stuff, questions from people that have been leaving tons of questions on the YouTube videos. And also in the background today, if you happen to hear any sort of massive things happening outside, we just had a bad storm and there's still lightning. So I hope we don't, I hope we do not miss anything here if my computer shuts off, but we'll find out.
Well, that's good. I tried to make sure that we timed up that weather out there in Iowa to make sure that you didn't lose any outside content time, you know, so you're able to be inside. So
yeah, exactly. I need to be out with my camera right now getting shots of everything that's fallen over and trees and everything. But
you and the insurance adjuster.
Yeah, exactly. So, of course, I was telling Ryan right before we started here that I was thinking about actually going and getting my Challenger out because I have not driven it in way too long. But then yesterday they said, oh, it won't rain today. So I was like, okay, I'm going to tell my wife maybe during her lunch we'll go pick it up out of storage and bring it home. Well, good thing I didn't do that. That's for sure.
Yeah, that was your gut or just the natural way, workings of the world helping you out there. So there'll be another time here this fall.
I think so.
Go for a 0% chance of rain.
Yeah. So how about we go right into some listener questions? And I think one of the main things that I saw as far as questions go this week was probably about crabgrass and what can you do about it before your renovations. I actually got a couple pictures in my email that I didn't show you, Ryan, but there was a lawn that I saw that was nearly, I would say, 90% crabgrass, and they were like, ooh, what should I do with this before, how can I get rid of it before I do my renovation? Or basically they wanted to overseed, and I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's not going to work. I mean, so, you know, it's tough because it's so pervasive, right? So if you do have it, maybe you have a couple of spots here and there, but usually that's what you see is a more widespread population of it in a yard. Then if you're going to try and do that, so, you know, will new crabgrass or new grass choke out crabgrass? I think it was one of the questions that came up that I saw and remember specifically regarding it. And the answer, the short answer is no, it will not. New grass is not going to choke out. It's not going to outcompete a summer annual, which crabgrass is in the peak of its growing season. So, you know, the real issue right now, especially here as we, you know, we get into mid-August or so, we're in a time, it's a weird spot in that life cycle of the crabgrass plant where it's seeding out right now. So it's producing seed stalks. Maybe it's already gone to seed. And it's really, really difficult to control because it's at the peak of its maturity right now. And so with that life cycle sort of coming to an end, you can use a couple of different things maybe to control that. Some of which are going to be more effective if you combine a couple of different modes of action as opposed to just relying on one of those things. So the three main herbicides that we have for crabgrass are going to be Tenacity is one, Pilox is another one. It's the same class of chemistry as what Tenacity is. And then Quinclorac is our third one. So each of them have their pluses and minuses. You can go and look up Quinclorac and, you know, use one of the affiliate links on Ryan's page to find it. But there's a bunch of different ones out there. Some of the newer liquid varieties or liquid formulations are a little bit more effective than the older dry flowable formulations. So take a look at that when you're, you know, comparing costs and things like that. That's an important part to look at. So the good news on Quinclorac, you can use it. It's seed safe the day of seeding. So if you really were pushing it to the limit and didn't have time to control it before you seeded, or if you maybe you're just going to do an overseeding and you have a little bit out there, you can spray that the same day you seed. It's safe. Beyond seeding, though, there's a little bit of a window depending on the species that you have, and it's all called out in the label. So I believe tall fescue, Don't quote me for sure, but I want to say it's two or three weeks on there. Kentucky bluegrass, perennial ryegrass are on there about the same, about anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. So it calls it out pretty specifically by species, and it's pretty easy to follow along with how long you need to wait if you go ahead and spray now, and then you're going to see it, say, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks later. So with Tenacity and Pilex, the nice thing there is Tenacity seed safe, and even post-seeding. You can spray it anytime before, during, after. It's not really an ideal standalone on crabgrass, but it can be really effective if you tank mix it. And Ryan, I think you did some of that too, where you were using it as a standalone and then maybe comparing it to some tank mixes.
Yeah,
is that right?
I was doing something similar to that. Yeah. I've noticed the same thing with Tenacity, to where it kind of feels like it's doing something, but then it kind of feels like it's sort of, it just doesn't really completely get everything. And so I found the same thing, like using two things together would be much better. And I think Tenacity maybe gets a bit of, I don't know, like praise that it does all things, but I don't think that I've found that's the case, especially too on stuff like clover and other stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, the way I always kind of tell it to people is, you know, you can use a wrench as a hammer, but it's really made to be a wrench, you know, so turning bolts, that sort of thing. And that's really where Tenacity kind of falls in for me, is it's a tool and it's a great thing to use in very specific situations, whether that be with a partner in the tank, like say Queen Chlorax. So, you know, we talk about tank mixes, and a pretty popular one would be, you know, 5 to 8 ounces per acre of Tenacity mixed with a full rate of Queen Chlorax. You know, that's going to pretty effectively take out even mature crabgrass. You're going to have pretty good success with that. And the other kicker there is too, a lot of times you'll spray or you'll get these chemicals, but there's also a really important section on that Queen Chlorax label about your adjuvant. So adjuvants help the chemicals stick to or enter the leaf of the weed that you're trying to get, and other plants too. But it's a really, really specific one called MSO, methylated seed oil. So you can buy that same thing probably through, again, one of your affiliate links or most any of the common turf supply, you know, websites that are out there right now. So methylated seed oil, MSO, that's a really key component to have in that that control mix for the crabgrass.
So you're talking about those newer liquid versions. Are there any ones that are particular you'd like to mention there maybe?
So the two big ones right now, Q-Ball, which is from New Farm, and then Drive Accelerate was really the one that kicked it off. So those two, so when you spell Drive, it's DRIVEXLR and the number 8. So if you look for those two, you know, they're generally going to be in that, I'd say, $75 to $85 for half a gallon, and that's going to get you just around an acre or half acre at the rate.
Okay. So in that case of a yard, like I was talking about, that's maybe 80, let's even say 75%, you really can't tell because it looks so covered, but what would be your suggestion in terms of a yard like that? I mean, would you just try to do one of these products, or would you just be looking at a full renovation of something like that?
You know, you've got to compare. Personally, if it was me, I would use a non-selective, and I'll tell you why. Personally, first and foremost, you want to make sure that you have complete control so that you can start fresh, right? And if you're not prepared to do that, then spraying selectively to control just crabgrass or some summer annuals, it's going to get pretty pricey versus the cost of a non-selective. So that's where you got to kind of weigh out, okay, even if I do spray this out and there is, say, 75%, what's the other 25%? Is it desirable turf and is it worth keeping? And I'd say if you're that high a population of crabgrass, what's left probably ain't the best grass in the world. So
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, when I looked at a picture like that, I was pretty much thinking, okay, I would just get rid of all of that and start over, because I doubt there's a whole lot of great stuff underneath it anyway. But
yeah, and that goes back into, you know, even when you do seed that and you do get a good catch and everything's coming up and you're doing a great job through fall, you know, one thing too, and this is something we can talk about in the future, is just pre-emergent strategies that following spring, because you're going to be at, you're still going to be at a competitive disadvantage with those new seedlings out there. I mean, they're going to gone through one winter, and so they're actually mature grass plants now, but you've got a ton of seed bank out there for crabgrass. And if you're not going to do anything about it, you're going to have some more problems down the road. So that's something I see people kind of get a little bit hesitant on, of either forgetting to, or just, like I said, hesitant because they feel like, oh, it's new seed, I've got to be careful. And you do, but there's still precautions you need to take and get that app out in the spring. So,
yep. That was my suggestion too, to a couple of people that are in that situation, is make sure your pre-emergent strategy going forward is going to work to prevent the situation that you're in right now. I think next question, this is still related to crabgrass, would be, let's say you don't have a ton of it, but you get pretty good control with those products that you were just talking about. What should a person do at that point to remove it out of the yard once it's dead, or they're going to be doing their seeding? What does that kind of look like? Because I think that's a common question too for people, is I've got weeds, I want to do weed control, and if they do it right, then they've got all these dead weeds sitting there, but they want to figure out, what do I do with them?
Yeah, so the mechanical removal part comes into, do you remove those with a shovel and backfill with a little bit of topsoil or something like that, all the way to, we talked about before, scalping a lawn down with a lawnmower. Do we just, depending on how big these spots are and big patches, but maybe it's just like a weed eater or a line trim or something like that, and you're just burning those down, as close as you can get into the ground in preparation for seeding. So something like that, if it's more of a small scale population that you're trying to control, I think those are good options. Mechanically. I mean, the other option is just rake out as much of that dead foliage as you can, bag it up and haul it off, and that should work too. You could also do it with the mower, but what I'm picturing in my head is more of spotty stuff that would be difficult to do with a mower, and more precise, surgical, that type of thing.
Would dethatching or scarifying or something like that do a decent job on there too, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say that would do a good job. Again, just make sure you remove that material, so you're not creating that layer of, organic and dead decaying material right there at the seed level, so or the soil surface.
Yep. This was one that I saw on my, I think it was on our last about renovations or somewhere, but it said, would vinegar work for killing the grass for a lawn renovation?
You need a lot of vinegar. I can't remember the concentration that most folks use on that. Let me Google that, because I'm kind of curious myself.
But. Well, and I tried this on some a couple of test plots down on some weeds that I had, and it was that whole mix it with the soap and the salt and spray everything, and they looked really good and killed for about 2 weeks or so, and then that was basically just the foliage that was on top of the ground, and then everything came back just like normal.
Yeah, and I think that's what you'd have to do is, as new leaves emerge that aren't stunted and burned by that first application, is continue to return, over the summer, and continue to spray out that new growth until such that, the root system collapses and the plant dies. So, like I said, that's why I say you would need a lot. It wouldn't just be like one shot, like you're out there with a fire hose, spraying the lawn down. It would be more of, okay, I'm going to start it might even be too late at this point, but probably starting around the 4th of July, and then like once a week, just going out there. What I'm seeing here, just in Googling it, I've never done it on a wide scale like that, but somewhere between 10% and 30% concentration of the vinegar is what seems to be the rule of thumb here. So again, it's a lot of vinegar.
Well, and I don't know if I have done enough research to speak on this, but I know that I feel like there was also a bit of risk to just thinking you can spray this huge mixture of vinegar and salt and everything all over the place and just think that it's perfectly fine for your soil too. I can't remember really who was talking about that, but I remember somewhere reading something about it.
Yeah, that's sort of the rub with reduced risk pesticides, is that they are a reduced risk to, different portions of the environment. So whether it be human or worker exposure, the people that are applying them, the people that are around that landscape, or if it's, fish and waterways and things like that, birds, insects, all that type of stuff. I mean, those things all need to be protected for sure. But, you know, if we're using something that's reduced risk, that's going to be, you know, a heavy oil that's going down in the soil, like, you can't tell me that's not going to have some type of impact on soil biology. So as we're trying to protect one thing, we're trading off, you know, hurting something else. And that's, you know, I think that's the case of anything that we do, a turf or agriculture or anything like that. So I think that's a lot of times we lose focus of what that trade-off really is, and truly trying to balance it all out and make the best decision. So not saying that spraying vinegar on your lawn is going to kill your soil or anything like that, but there is going to be, you know, at least a temporary impact that you need to weigh when considering other alternatives. Mm-hmm.
So there were three other main types of weeds that I saw asked about here. So one was nutsedge, two creeping Charlie, and three would be clover, in terms of what to do about those things before you get to a renovation of some kind.
So, you know, on the clover part, that one's tough because it's a perennial plant and it's always going to be a problem. I think even if you do control it, you're just not seeing it, and you've reduced the population such that you don't see it, but it will undoubtedly come back. So, you know, we talked about quinclorac here a little bit ago. Quinclorac and a product that contains carfentrazone, so like a speed zone, is actually a pretty effective duo against that. Dicamba is also another active ingredient that is very, very effective against clover on its own. But when you combine those two things together, you do get some pretty good activity and you can get some pretty good knockdown. So again, it's all about those seed windows. So something like speed zones, a nice one because it's got dicamba and it's got carfentrazone in it, and you can add quinclorac to that at the same time. So with quinclorac, again, you're safe at day of seeding and you can't apply until a couple weeks after. Speed zone is actually seed safe in 7 days, you know, so you can spray it and then 7 days later go ahead and seed, because they've reduced some of the amount of chemicals that are in there, some of the actives that are in there, to make that seed safe in a quicker manner. So if you were trying to do that, I'd look at those two products in concert, especially if you really have a lot of control over to control. Nutsedge, you know, you've got two main products there. So Sedge Hammer, which is halosulfuron, and Dismiss, which is sulfentrazone. Both of them on the label have a 4-week seed interval. I've had no issues with Sedge Hammer going out right close to seeding time and spraying that stuff and having any issue with seeding seeds coming up, germinating, all that kind of stuff. Sulfentrazone maybe a little bit more persistent in terms of maybe having to wait that full 4 weeks. So I'd just be careful with sulfentrazone if that's what you're going to use. So with those products, you know, the sulfentrazone, the Dismiss is a little bit quicker in its activity and what you see on the burn down of that nutsedge. Halosulfuron or Sedge Hammer, a little bit slower, but my experience, if I was going to pick between those two, I'd pick Sedge Hammer. So, and then what was our last one?
The last one was, and also on Nutsedge, I've even had some trouble. That stuff is just so resilient, even with sometimes with glyphosate, it just does not want to give up. So, and clover is bane of my existence at this point. So,
clover, you know, those are two plants that, you know, they're different than your typical broadleaves, right? So, you know, you've got sedge is actually in the grass family, right? So the way we tell that, it's triangular stem. That's the easiest way to ID that. But the big thing about nutsedge, with it being a tuber, you know, just like a potato, you cut that little eye out of the potato and plant it in the ground, and new potato plants pop up and keep going. Well, that's the same thing with this. There's a lot of carbohydrates stored in that tuber for that plant to survive a heck of a lot of abuse, including herbicide applications. And so there's no question that it's a difficult to control weed. You know, I've seen a lot of different things get sprayed for sedges thinking that it's been, you know, it's been turned away, only for it to just rise right back up off the mat and take a big healthy swing at you and let you know it's still there. So you can't, it's one of those ones you just can't be discouraged by. You just have to keep on top of. So I still think the Sledgehammer is a good product. I've seen more success with that over the long term than with Dismiss. Not saying that Dismiss isn't a bad product, but it's just what I've seen in my experience. So,
yeah, I've had pretty good luck with Sledgehammer as well, or the generic, or basically same thing. But
yep, Pro Sedge is another one. Yep, yeah. Same thing.
The last one was Creeping Charlie.
Ooh, yeah. So, I mean, Triclopyr is lights out on that stuff. That's no problem. You've got a 3-week seed interval on that. So, yeah, follow the label, and Triclopyr is going to be your best bet. So, you should have no problem taking out Creeping Charlie.
Cool. This is moving to something that's not really extremely, I guess, related to renovation, but kind of. So, this question was about dogs and dog spots, and essentially, year after year, this person has been dealing with dog spots, and they seem to have issues growing grass back into those spots, and they're wondering what else could be the problem, what sort of things they could do. And I think this is a common question, too, a lot of times on, you know, the more people that have dogs, which is seems like pretty much everyone now, it's become quite an issue with lawns.
You know, I've seen a couple of products that are commercially advertised for this, and I haven't really investigated them too deeply. You know, so it's my understanding, and again, don't have dogs peeing on sports fields and golf courses too often, but, so it's not a very, well-studied problem for me, but it would seem that, you know, your salts and ammonia buildup and that type of thing would be your key issue there. So, if you can water and flush some of those through, I think that would be key. And then with these products that I've seen, I'm not sure what they're using. So like it could be some type of like an activated carbon that's trying to draw all that stuff to it and sequester it so that it can't affect soil structure, roots or things like that, water availability, whatever the case might be. So there could be some of that. I could also see some products being more like either like a flocculator, so like gypsum or something like that, that's going to push salt off of cations and flush it down through. So it could be a couple of those things. And those are some of those strategies that I'd be interested in trying myself before I recommend something. But as far as, you know, adding more seed and everything like that too, is just try and flush those out with a hose. That would be my biggest thing is, you know, pound those anytime you can. And try to flush water through there before you go back in and reseed. If you reseed into sodic or salty soil, that's going to be kind of a non-starter right off the get-go.
That's basically what I try to do most with our dogs is just, you know, train them to go in certain areas that you're not either the grass there you don't really care as much about, or you have to sort of watch them and figure out, you know, what areas you're going to have to flush with water before you're going to find a bunch of spots. Because we have small dogs, but they still, especially the females, you know, it's very concentrated in one little area, and it does not take long before that spot will be gone. So
no question.
That's kind of what I do. I mean, I've seen a lot of people who say, oh, you should give your dog, you know, there's all these types of products like that you supposedly can give to the dog and it doesn't produce as much whatever. But personally, I don't know if I really trust that or what it's doing to the dog. So I just don't really like that route myself, but that's just my opinion. Okay, here we go. Wondering if you've ever dealt with and had any success dealing with Poa annua. This is the age-old question, Ryan.
Well, I mean, this is like the Godfather series. We could go on for, you know, multi-part 3-hour podcast here. Have I ever been successful in dealing with it? Was that the question?
Yeah, have you ever dealt with and had success dealing with Poa annua?
Oh, I've had plenty of success and plenty of failure. So it's, you know, you make a choice, and in lawns, it does stick out a little bit more, and it's harder to manage at that height. But, you know, we talked a little bit. I did see a question in the video, I think on the YouTube page about why would I include tenacity if I don't have crabgrass or if I don't have, so, you know, there's some interesting stuff, and it's a good spot to talk about it now. We're going to talk about, you know, post-renovation care today, more on the fertility side, but I'll talk about it on the chemical side here for a second, is, you know, why do we put Tenacity out? Well, part of it, it does have some pre-emergent properties for Poa annua specifically, and it's safe at seeding. It's one of the only ones that we have that's available. So there's another one that's available, and I'm not even sure if it's labeled for home lawns, Tupersan. Sidron is the active ingredient. It's an incredibly expensive chemical. So that was the only other seed-safe pre-emergent herbicide before Tenacity came on the market. So with Tenacity, you do get in that first year, in that first fall, Rutgers did this work, 8, 9, 10 years ago, where they found that, you know, from a Poa annua standpoint, you do keep out roughly 50 to 60% of your populations versus an untreated with Tenacity. So if you're trying to fight that battle, you got to start off on the right foot, and 50 or 60% doesn't sound like, you know, a ton. Obviously it's a majority, but that's a big number, you know, especially with a grass that seeds itself and provides its own seed bank and continually germinates there. So that's one thing too, from a strategy standpoint. I mean, a lot of people will wait until they're ready to go out with their seed, and especially if you're going late. Poa annua is germinating earlier and earlier here in the Midwest. You know, so we see, you know, they typically talk about when soil temperatures go below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's true for the most part, but that means getting your pre-emergent out sometime in August and then keeping it up. So it's going to be a multi-app process where if we're trying to do or trying to prevent Poa annua in a renovation, whether it's an overseed or a renovation, you know, that's going to be a multi-step process of, you know, we're going out in August, you know, perhaps when we seed, or we're making our first app 3 or 4 weeks before we do seed, and then we're doing another one at seeding, and then we're doing another one to follow that up later into October. So things like that do tip the scales, and that's how you start. As far as managing it and dealing with it, again, that's a whole other topic of how you can keep it at bay. Yeah. And it's really, you know, it's an all-encompassing approach. It is not just spray it and it's going to go away. It is removing it by hand. It is making sure that your maintenance practices are such that you're not favoring it over your more desirable grasses, all the way to using chemicals is kind of the tip of the spear if you have to get to that point. Mm-hmm. So
I think there's a couple of products too that, you know, if you already have some existing, you're not doing renovation, but you're in an existing thing that you're dealing with. I know a lot of people in the Pacific Northwest talk about that a lot because of their climate there, and it doesn't necessarily get so hot in the summer and stuff. But I think there are a few products, but for homeowners, they get so expensive at this point that it's kind of difficult to recommend that. I mean, I have showed a few people, and I'm like, just don't fall out of your chair when you see the price, but...
Well, and that's all this though, man. It's how far do you want to go and how much do you want to spend and is it really worth it? And it's that value judgment, right? I mean, I think you do these things sometimes out of experience and sometimes out of hope that things will get better or that you'll be able to make an improvement or whatever it is that you're prioritizing. I think that's the main thing though, is that we see a lot of these products. So like the one that you're probably talking about is ethofumisate. Mm-hmm. So Poa constrictor, Prograss, it goes under several different trade names, but it's a very effective product. It's also one that you have to be very careful with depending on and know what your populations of all of your different cool season grasses are, because it's harder on some than it is others. And so I won't get into that right now other than to say that we can do an episode on that in the future for sure. But to your point, there aren't a whole lot of solutions when it comes to just a silver bullet product that's going to come down the pike and mm-hmm. take care of it all.
In terms of the sports turf world, what are you seeing out there? Like, what would you have to do in terms of your strategies in that world?
So there's a few different things. I mean, and let's just start in golf, because golf is where Poa, depending on where you're at, could be the most, you know, widely desired grass. And that's what, you know, some of the best putting greens in the world are growing right now. And then there's other places where it's a four-letter word and they can't wait to get rid of it. So in golf, you've seen a couple of different avenues. Like I said, the mechanical removal part on greens, especially back when I was in golf, you know, we would go through our greens. We had about just a little over 3 acres of actual green surface, and we would go through cup cutter size plugs, just over about 2,000 of those. So about 1,000 in the spring and 1,000 in the fall of just taking, putting a bent grass plug in its place and taking the POA out and trashing and burning it, just get rid of it. So that's obviously a very, very labor intensive process, but it kept us clean, you know. So the other things too would be growth regulators. There's some that are very antagonistic to POA annua, and you see this in sports and golf, but Anew, which is one of the newer PGRs on the market, it's been shown to be pretty hard on POA, not quite as hard as its predecessor, or one of its predecessors, which is paclobutrazol. So paclobutrazol was first looked at as a fungicide, and it actually became a PGR because it had such great plant growth regulating properties, more so than fungistatic properties to stop, you know, fungus from growing. So that you can see guys doing programs, especially using the heat of the summer to their advantage, where they will put that stuff out all summer long on a pretty regular schedule. And it slows bent and it slows down most any grass pretty healthily. It's a root absorbed PGR. It's a little bit different than what we're used to with Trinexin pacethyl with T-Nex and Primo and those sort of ones. But yeah, so it's really hard on POA, and you can actually really see some gains in terms of if you're trying to, you know, favor, let's say, bent grass over POA in a golf course fairway or tee or something like that versus, you know, in a sports field where we've got bluegrass and POA right next to each other. They're in the same family, so it gets kind of tough. Same species, actually. So when we get into that whole situation where we're trying to take one grass out of another, it makes it really, really difficult. So one of the more interesting things in POA control and sports turf that's kind of evolved here over the last 10 years is a process called phrase mowing. I think you actually had a question about that.
Yeah, I think someone asked if you had ever done that or were familiar sort of with the process.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the big reasons that came about, it came about over in Europe, and they were renovating soccer pitches so frequently, and with their climate and playing through the winter, POA is a really, really big problem for them because it's continually germinating as they're playing and as they're divoting up the field and creating more voids for it to fill. And so they needed a way to quickly remove all that stuff and put back new and desirable grass. So typically, they're playing on ryegrass over there, so a gentleman over there invented this. It looks like a milling machine essentially for pavement, except they use it on grass, and it rips up, you know, you can adjust it all the way from an eighth of an inch down below an inch. Now usually you're only going to go like a quarter or so to a half maybe at a time and just go down on lifts. But what they were finding is they could rip out the POA plant and all of its little shallow root system and pull that out pretty effectively. And so when they grew in, every time they were doing this phrase mowing process, so whether it was once a year, that type of thing, they were continually removing more and more and more POA, so it couldn't get a foothold, couldn't seed quick enough to build up that seed bank, so on and so forth. So that has been a pretty effective thing. Now, obviously, in a home mowing situation, there's probably not a lot of people doing that, but and even in pro sports here in the States, it's a little bit more difficult because schedules and even, heck, rec and parks or at the high school level, it's difficult because schedules are so packed and so tight right now that it's hard to take a field out for, say, 3 or 4 months while you grow in a new field, whether it be a blue rye mix or just 100% rye. I mean, it just depends on all those situations, time of year, that sort of thing.
That was going to be my question, is what's the recovery time kind of on that? Because that would definitely be difficult around, like, especially what you're working with a lot of high school stuff or all that stuff here where it's nearly traffic on it all the time.
There's been some really interesting stuff. There's a guy that sort of, I wouldn't say pioneered it over here, but he was really one of the flagship folks in the States that adopted it, early adopters, I would say, and ran a soccer complex out in Maryland area. And they were turning around fields in 30 to 45 days. So they would strip it with the phrase mower and then immediately seed it. And they were usually using 3 pounds per thousand of Kentucky bluegrass and 5 pounds per thousand of perennial ryegrass at the same time. Seed it, put it on a very, very aggressive fertilizer program, and then play on it somewhere between 5 and 8 weeks later. So it was pretty impressive to see that type of setup. And I don't know that anybody's been that aggressive here as of late, but it's definitely a tool. It's up and coming, and it's trying to get it figured out of how it can be applicable in a high-end or high-maintenance lawn situation.
I was talking to, or I got a message from a grad student at Purdue who was doing some studying on this. I think it's like his main thing that he's studying right now. But he was also studying it for more of like a homeowner situation and doing sort of like a makeshift little... He was using like bolts onto a blade and like actually using a regular mower. Gosh. So just to like see what would happen and do some testing and studies and stuff. And he was like, it's kind of fascinating. But
Somebody showed me that, or I can't remember where I saw that. I think it might've been, if it was on Twitter or something like that. I know what you're talking about though, where it was like a rotary version.
Yes.
And it was, that was interesting for sure. Mm-hmm. So I think somebody's going to figure out how to put that in a package that can work. I mean, the biggest thing is it just needs so much damn torque to make it work. So you have to have, you know, a pretty decent sized tractor, even if you run one of the small ones. But I'm waiting for one of them to end up on like the front end of like a Toro Dingo or something like that, like a small walk behind unit.
Yeah.
That you can just, then you'll be set, Ryan.
Yeah.
And you'll be all set.
That's what I'm looking forward to, I think.
There you go.
So I think this was a good question too. What do you think about the rhizomatous tall fescue or perennial ryegrass? There's been a whole bunch of talk about this stuff because both of those types of grass, people, you know, find fault because they don't spread like bluegrass. But I think there's some other advantages to them, you know, as far as much faster establishment and all that stuff goes. But these new varieties that are supposedly spreading, you know, what's your experience with that or how much they spread, all that?
I don't think they spread much. I think that they produce plant parts that are able to be classified as rhizomes. And there's some, I would agree with you that there's some effect in the way that they establish and get going. So in my experience has been vastly different between the tall fescue varieties and the perennial ryegrass varieties, such that the RPR, the regenerative perennial ryegrass, I've seen very, very little difference in that versus a high end, like three way rye, and not just like your run of the mill stuff, but a better than average three way rye. So ryegrasses can get pretty squirrely pretty quickly once you get past like the top of the heap as far as NTEP and performance and everything like that. There's a lot of different ones out there. Tall fescue, there's a blend from Seed Research of Oregon, which is Trophy XRE, so it's extreme rhizome expression, and you know that's like a three or four way, I want to say, blend of rhizomatous tall fescue varieties, and always had really good luck with it. It's a fine product. There's nothing wrong with it, but I wouldn't expect it to be filling in, you know, 3-inch wide voids in my yard the way that Kentucky bluegrass could or should. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. I think there's, you know, it's good that they're trying to breed some of that stuff into the plants and try to look for the expression of those genes. But then it's also, okay, if I'm getting this recuperative potential or claimed benefit of recuperative potential, what am I trading off to get that? And again, that's where you need to dig into the data and see what else you see from it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's been kind of interesting because bluegrass, you know, it's not still like a Bermuda plant or something to where it still takes some time to fill in some things. So it's not just like crazy filling in stuff in days either, but
Yeah. No, and that's, you know, again, like just, we talked about this in the last episode, is expectations are crucial. And there's so many things out there right now that are getting blasted into people's inboxes and on their web browser and the retargeting ads and everything like that of, this is it. This is the solution. I'm not here to talk bad about anybody's products or the marketing. They're free and clear to do what they want to do. But I'm here to tell you that in 25 years of doing this, you know, there might be a game changing product like that, that comes out maybe once every 5 to 7 years. And usually it is insanely expensive to the point that no homeowner would be able to, one, legally buy it because it might not be labeled for homeowner use, or two, it is, so, you know, it's just so far out there price wise that they can't touch it, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's either not labeled, it's too expensive, whatever the case might be. My point is this, is that knowledge and experience will trump chemistry just about any day of the week, right? There are so many things out there that people are touting as, this is the best or that's the best. Educate yourself on why, and find good resources to verify and vet what you're being told. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the YouTube community is a slippery slope. You know, I think not everybody's pushing as hard to sell something as some of the others, but you have to step back for a moment and understand who your source is, right?
Yep.
So I'm not the only source. You know, I think that's the other thing too, is that there's folks out there that want to be gatekeepers of information, you know, only give you enough to keep you coming back and that sort of thing. And I'd rather talk to you about it, give you some background, point you in the right direction of where to get more info, and then let you, you know, if you want to come back and talk after you've, you know, looked into it more, either through that source or other ones that you find beyond that, great. But this whole thing of building your own knowledge base and your own experience base, I understand people are busy and all that, but if you truly want to know if you're spending good money or good time doing what you're doing, put the time in on the front end to find that out first for yourself.
Yep. And I think, speaking honestly about that from my perspective of being on YouTube and, you know, my education from the beginning up until now and meeting people like you and all these people that I've met that have really helped me further my knowledge, I take a huge responsibility in terms of the audience that I have and what information comes out to them. And the hardest part about YouTube is that it's so sensationalized, I guess I would say, in terms of, you've got to have, you know, you're telling people all the time this huge thing that happened, and all the thumbnails have to in the titles. And it's just the way the world works in terms of everything on the internet. And it's very difficult to bridge the gap between still finding that audience and trying to make sure people are watching, but then also not just everything being about, this is the best product you should buy today.
Yeah. Whenever I get the feeling that Macho Man Randy Savage is going to have me snap into a Slim Jim and use this lawn product, I tune out pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like I just, that's not really my, my motif, if you will, on YouTube lawn videos. But yeah, I'm not, again, not begrudging, the folks that do that. I understand it's a business, and you know, you're there to showcase who you are, what you do, your personality, this, that, and the other thing. But at the same time, you do have a responsibility, because there are, you know, thousands and thousands of people watching. And if they're going to take your word as the gospel, let's say, then you better make sure that you're right. You know, I would want to be, I would feel personally responsible for that if I was trying to do something like that. Now, you know, we get on here and we talk, and I'm giving, you know, I try to be as factual as I can. I try to at least let everybody know if I'm giving an opinion, and if people don't agree with it, that's fine. But it's more about trying to get people led to the right direction. So, you know, when people want to know more information, I think those are the types of answers that I think we both want to be able to provide, right? Is, hey, here's, you know, a little bit of background on it. Here's where you can learn more. I think we had a great question come on there, and we should dive into it in a future episode about fine fescue. We didn't talk about fine fescue at all, mm-hmm. which I do kind of feel bad about. It is like the redheaded stepchild. But cool thing is the golden gophers They're actually kind of like the preeminent university or academic group that's researching those right now. So they've got a ton of good information, more than I could ever provide.
Yep.
So we can talk a little bit about it, go through it a little bit, and then maybe, you know, we get Eric from University of Minnesota on here and we talk fine fescue.
That would be fantastic. I mean, last winter, I think I was talking to our friend there that lives up in North Dakota, and he was talking about his fine fescue. You know who I'm talking about, Evan.
Sure.
And he's like, I don't know. I don't understand why nobody talks about fine fescue. I'm like, well, it's a very difficult grass for most regions that just isn't really all that possible. But the Minnesota, it's possible, yes, but
it doesn't fit into the paradigm of what we would consider lawn care, right, in this country. So, like, if you're going to do a four-step program and, you know, just go kind of willy-nilly, I'm going to throw it in there because we got to get at least one in on every show.
Yes.
But if you're going to go willy-nilly with herbicides, like, there's a lot of restraint that needs to be practiced with fine fescues. And I think that's probably the hard thing is, like, and this goes back to, you know, I think there was a comment on this and we just sort of talked about it or led into this, but this feeling that, man, this thing looks like crap right now. I got to do something. Like this feeling, like I know what that feels like. I mean, when you have a golf course or sports fields or multiple of all those things, you know, that crushing anxiety of God, like it just doesn't look right. Or it's not in a good spot. And I know there's bad weather coming here in another day or three or next week or whatever. And you're just on pins and needles. And so that's again why you make a rock solid plan. And we talked about this before, you know, that starts in the fall, that starts here in another 30 days of getting, you know, your soil right, getting your roots right, doing all those things to set yourself up for, you know, hopefully a good spring and then a tough summer. And then you start over again. And no product is going to take the place of a proper plan and executing it and adjusting too. Mm-hmm. Things aren't always going to go according to plan, as we well know. And so the grass is no different. It's a constant battle. But yeah, fine fescue, we'll definitely dig into that. And maybe we can get, like I said, get Eric on here, and then maybe we can get Evan on here to be like a celebrity guest.
Real mode fine fescue is in my future. That's what I want to do somewhere. I just need to find a better shady spot and somewhere it won't get so toasty every day.
Yeah.
So we've got our renovation going. I think we want to switch gears here just a bit to aftercare and the fall season and what we should do there. A little update on what I'm doing. I got the ryegrass was up in 3 days on the renovation that I'm working on. And then the bluegrass starting about 6 days and 6 and 7, it started to look pretty good and it was popping up there. So that's nice. Pretty exciting stuff.
It's always exciting when it first starts. And then, you know, you just have to kind of pray and hang on that you don't get some bad weather or a thunderstorm washing it all out or something like that. That's the, you know, the one thing about like bluegrass, you always have that that long wait, and then the you know the other long wait after it gets going or whatever. But yeah, I think the care. You know, we talked about the mowing, and I thought, you know, after thinking about what we had talked about, I felt pretty good about that. But the fertilizer thing is something that you see a lot of different recommendations out there of, you know, continuing to pound a starter, you know, after the fact. And I think this is where, again, testing your soil and understanding what you have going into it is such a crucial step. It's not that you're going to waste money or anything like that. I guess, you know, a few bucks here and there for a bag of fertilizer or trying to find the right fertilizer, so to speak. That's important and everything. But you can make this a pretty inexpensive endeavor if you really want to, meaning that if you might only need nitrogen to keep pushing, you know, after that initial starter app. So if that's the case, then, you know, if you get ammonium sulfate 2100, or if you get urea 4600 and just use that and ride it out through the fall like that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The plant doesn't know the difference. So, you know, I don't know what's been your sort of, you know, you've tried a bunch of different times, a bunch of different ways. What's been your program of choice?
You know, I think I've pretty much gone with the starter down at the beginning, and then probably maybe a month in, four to, I don't know, exact timing. I just kind of have watched things and see Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's growing well, but it looks like it needs to fill in a bit more or something like that. And that's kind of that point where I look at it. Last year, though, on bluegrass, I was doing much more of a spoon feeding program, more like lower rates, maybe around a quarter of a pound more often, and going at it that way instead of, you know, waiting 4 to 6 weeks and then putting a higher dose on. I was just kind of going more pushing it little by little by little, and that seemed to work pretty well on the bluegrass.
Yeah, 100% agree that if you can do that, and it can be hard to spread a quarter pound of even 2100. So, you know, don't feel necessarily compelled that you have to do that. You can spray it as well. It just takes a little bit more figuring out with equipment and making sure that your rates are proper and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think I would agree with that, you know, quarter pound every 10 to 14 days and just kind of nudge it along. You know, in those 10 to 14 day cycles, what ends up happening is, you know, if you imagine it just like the old frequency curve, right? So we want to flatten that out as much as possible. We don't want it to drop down so low to the bottom that, oh, we don't have enough in and the grass is looking peaked and weak and things like that. And then we just go out and bomb, you know, a pound of N out there. And the other thing too, especially on new grass, like the whole idea that you need to have any slow release out there, you can, like, yeah, but I wouldn't be spending money on a bag that's anything more than like 30% slow release. It's just not going to be a very valuable thing for you to do at that point. A lot of those things are going to be depending on your end source. And I know somebody asked about that, and that'll definitely be another video that we can jump into. But as far as the end sources that you have out there, they're going to be reliant on microbial activity, which is reliant on soil temperature. Well, as you get further and further in the fall, those are declining. And then the other one is the potential of water getting it into the plant, right? So like we're losing that evapotranspiration that we talked about in our first video about heat stress. So those two things are kind of working against you. So reduced rates and watching the weather, those are going to be your best bets. But you know, the other thing too is if you've got a soil test that shows deficiencies in other areas, like you're probably not going to make it up in just one app most of the time. So that's going to be something where, from a maintenance standpoint and going through the growing period, you're going to want to add supplemental nutrients, whether it be PK, micros, whatever. So again, trying to get a baseline on that ahead of time is a really, really crucial step. And then the other thing that I did want to talk about in regards to some of the newer bluegrass varieties would be, you've got these new super elites, especially on bluegrass, where they don't need as much N. And I really experienced this last year with a pretty large grow-in, like 6 acres of like some of the highest end blues you'll find, and was told by multiple people, you know, we're talking about grow-in and everything like that. And I got from multiple sources, I had people telling me, hey, you should probably back down your N. I'm thinking, why, you know, why would this be? And so I actually called the seed company, the people that bred it, and talked to them. And they were like, yeah, we're, you know, when we go and select these things, we're trying to put them through as much stress as we can. Whether that be nutrient stress, drought stress, disease pressure, all that type of thing. So they've been adapted and cultured on their own to do more with less. And so we had one section that we did, it was kind of out of the way, might've been about a half an acre or so, where I just pounded it like I normally would. Probably got like close to 4 pounds of N from August until like Thanksgiving. And then had another section where the rest of the 5.5 or so acres where we just backed down. You know, we did a half a pound of N at seeding, and then we did a quarter pound every 2 weeks through mid October. And then we did one more foliar app like right towards Thanksgiving or so. And at that point, the stuff that the 5.5 acres was like perfect. You know, the stuff that that we really pushed hard, it just was a little bit more leggy. Was very, very dense for sure. But it just didn't look as good as what the stuff that we backed down and just did kind of a, not the bare minimum, but what I would call a reduced rate over what I've done in the past. So something to keep your eye on that, again, just, you know, you can always pound it, and nitrogen is always going to produce a plant response if you have a healthy plant. But too much leads to luxury consumption, and luxury consumption is something that can cause other issues, and you're not going to have disease problems and that sort of thing in the fall like that. But are you doing the best with what you have and what you know you can do? Mm-hmm. That's my thing, is not over applying, that sort of thing.
Well, and I think you made a couple good points there on a couple things would be, you know, something like Milorganite or a product like that. A lot of people in the past have liked to say, when should I put that down on a renovation? Or they're liking to use it maybe mid to late fall, and it's just not a whole lot of soil activity going on there to really do a lot with it. So that's one thing. But then the second thing is just, it comes back to what we've talked about a couple times in my mind, is if you're at the 3-week mark and you're like, oh, I don't know, should I put it down or should I wait until 5 weeks? Or like, whatever you're doing, I don't think it needs to be, you don't really need to overthink too much to where you're going to do any sort of major damage. Or I think just the point I was trying to make was, don't get too freaked out about exact timing, or there's all these different experiments you can do, which I've done over time, and in the end results come out fine.
Yeah. I mean, and something too that could be useful is, especially if you're following like your yard and, allowing it to burn out here during this time, is, you know, you don't want to over apply, but you could get some stuff that is more of a slower release product, because now you'll still get some bounce out of it coming into your renovation and that sort of thing. But calibrate, figure out what that calibration is now, and you're not going to hurt anything on dead grass. You don't want to go crazy. You want to get pretty close, but you got to figure out what that calibration is if you're spraying or spreading. So use this time to your advantage. And this is part of the preparation stuff. You know, we talk about all this, like, you know, pressing right now, this is what you should be doing. And everybody has all these videos, but it's like, there's a lot of stuff that precedes that, that doesn't get talked about, that, you know, it's like algebra. If I don't know algebra and I go to learn something, you know, further on down in the book, it's like, well, I don't know what this is because I didn't learn the first part, or I don't understand this first part.
Yep.
You gotta have that mindset that, there's a lot of important stuff that goes into preparing and getting yourself ready, more so than just sourcing everything and making sure it's there on the day that you're going to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's completely true. I mean, if you've never used a spreader before, or you've never sprayed anything, and then you're going to try to do that on the day that you're doing renovation, that's not exactly a great plan.
Well, and here's me again. I'm just me. I'm not, you know, the end all be all, but I'd still calibrate if we were going out and doing a seeding project. I don't think, you know, I don't care if, you know, somebody says, oh yeah, you know, I just did that job last week and the spreader setting is this and it's going to be fine. It's like, let's just take 10 minutes and check it. Yep. You know,
that's what I did on my renovation. I just got up my little scale, got my little cups of seed, put them in one by one and measured all the weight. And, you know, I then set my spreader at a low setting and went over it as many times as I needed to get even coverage. But then I knew exactly how much seed had gone out onto the yard. I wasn't just taking a willy-nilly guess.
Yeah, could you take that willy-nilly guess and get away with it? Yeah, probably, maybe, I don't know. But again, here's my thing is, if you've expended all these all this energy to get to this point, and if you've expended all this money to get to this point, and let's be honest, if there's someone other than you living in the house, you've expended a significant amount of political capital to get there, you damn well better get it right.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. That is for sure. I've always said, I don't think it takes much more time to do it right than it does to do it just kind of halfway. So
what's the old John Wooden quote? If you don't have time to do it right the first time, how are you going to have time to do it over?
Yep.
So I think on the N rates, it's just like you said. The other thing too, like we talked about with temps and that whole way that N gets in the plant, I would be more frequent on the front end as temperatures are still high and the plant's still demanding water and that sort of thing, and back off a little bit in the fall. Like there's this whole, that's a whole other topic of late season fertilization, something that's changed mm-hmm. significantly. And I would love to talk about that on a future episode, because that's one thing where there are some serious dogmas out there about what has worked, why it's worked. And there's a new method. There's a proven method from replicated research now that kind of flips the script on that.
Yes.
And so that's more on established turf, but insofar as we know that mechanism that we call mass flow. So again, a plant demands water. When it demands water, it's pulling not just the water, but the nitrogen that's in the solution of that water into it. And that's how it uses it, right? You can get in through the leaves and everything like that. It's not a very efficient process with seedlings, especially. So if we're going to use root absorbed nitrogen, it's got to come in the way of, okay, the plant's demanding water, it's going to take it up and go. So as that demand for water wanes, as we get into those cooler, shorter days of October and things like that, that's where you can stretch out your frequency a little bit more, because it's just not going to be pulling as much nitrogen out of the soil. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think we should definitely talk about that later as we get into the fall here, about sort of the winterization, and that's a good topic for sure.
And I hope our producer's writing down all these great show ideas.
I know you should be right now. So let's switch just a second here to overseeding care. There was a couple topics I think there you wanted to talk about, a little about PGR rebound and your moisture management of overseeding.
Yeah, just with the PGR rebound, like we talked about, like trying to do two apps. So your first app prior to your second app, right around or day of seeding, and trying to ride that rebound so that you might need to, it gets real tricky with grass that comes up quick. So like ryegrass and that sort of thing. But if you can ride that rebound to wait until you've got grass up and you're maybe 3 or so weeks into it, and then you get that rebound, that flush of growth that kind of pushes everything along and makes it fill in that much quicker. So using your desirable grasses that have been left behind that you've overseeded into, plus your new seed, you kind of get a little bit of a fill-in effect, especially if you have Kentucky bluegrass that you're doing. If it's on a bunch type grass like fine fescue, tall fescue, or perennial ryegrass, it makes it a little bit more challenging, but it's something that you should probably consider about the timing of those and how you're gonna back out of that. When it stops, when am I going to come out of regulation, and where will my seed be in terms of germination and establishment at that point? So, and you know, the other thing too with the overseeding care, you know, moisture management, people I think that, well, it's one of two things. Either they don't water it and they don't give it the time of day, and that's just as dangerous as watering it like it's a new grow in and we've got to keep all these seeds like super, super moist. There's a couple of caveats there. One being that you already have existing grass that's going to demand moisture, right? So it's competing for moisture just the same, and it's going to outcompete a seedling 10 times out of 10. So you have to take that into account. And the other thing too is if you're doing this earlier on when you might still have some humidity or some disease pressure, is, you know, don't want to overdo it and wipe out, you know, patches or a big spot on your existing lawn, on the existing grass, and create more problems for yourself in that regard. So, you know, that's one where, you know, if we had to balance this out between regular watering of a, you know, a mature stand of grass on one side of the equation versus, you know, the process of watering a renovated bare soil lawn on the other side of the equation, you kind of want to be somewhere in the middle, but you got to play the weather. You know, you're going to have demands on your existing grass that, again, if it gets hot and dry and that sort of thing, it's going to need some more water just the same as your seed's going to. So don't be afraid to water it multiple times a day, just like we talked about for the renovation lawn.
Yep.
But just keep an eye on it, because you're trying to manage two different things. You're trying to manage two things that are on opposite ends of the spectrum there between the new seed and your existing grass.
Yeah. I found that for me, it's definitely true, but I with that, you have to be kind of on top of it. But I think that the overseeding has been much more, I wouldn't say it's easy, but you have that existing grass there to where it holds in the moisture better. And especially if you did something like coreation and you got a bunch of cores there, you can kind of visually see when it's getting wet and when it doesn't need any more than that. But I've had so much success with the overseeding just because it's you're not on bare ground there where it can dry out so much faster.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that grass essentially acts as like a mulch, right? You know, so it holds in some of that moisture, protects it from evaporation from the sun, that sort of thing. So there's definitely some advantages to doing it. It's just, again, making sure that you're managing the moisture such that you don't just have seed that is sitting out there and you're not taking advantage of your weather right now, and especially the sunlight, the day length, and the heat to get that stuff up and going.
Mm-hmm. This wasn't really on our list here of preparation, but it's something that I saw yesterday that I thought maybe would be also a good question here. When you were talking about putting down seed, you were saying there's some new seeds that are coated with, you know, a fungicide, but I saw some questions yesterday about if you did have fungus coming in early on, or even if you didn't, would a fungicide be okay on the new seed, and sort of what would be a strategy there if you needed to use something?
So the coated seeds, that's sort of the point. So they're coated with a chemical called metalaxyl, which is basically preventing damping off Pythium, like the waterborne type funguses that you're going to get when you're in a high moisture situation like a grow-in, right? So that's part of the reason they put them on there. They've been doing it in agriculture for a number of years and sort of brought it over to turf. And where I find the value in it is, you know, so like right now, so in this middle of August stretch when it's still hot, we're trying to take advantage of day length, we're trying to take advantage of temperature and able to control moisture a little bit more than we would have later in the fall. You're going out kind of early, right? You're going to have some high temps and maybe some precarious situations as far as temperature, dew point, soil moisture, that sort of thing. So that's where they can be effective, where for the first, you know, 7 to 10 days, you got some protection there as that seed emerges and comes out. Beyond that, yeah, it would be beneficial, I guess, to have some of that stuff on the shelf. So again, a product like Mefenoxam, you know, where you can knock down Pythium and those other damping off those other waterborne diseases pretty quickly if you need to. And again, that's just an investment. I look at that as having it on the shelf, not a bad thing, especially on a grown where you've already spent, again, the time, the money, the effort. I look at it as an insurance policy. And truth be told, you're probably going to use it in the future at some point when it gets hot and wet together, because it's bound to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep. Yeah, I haven't, crossing my fingers, I haven't seen anything too crazy on the project that I'm working on right now, but it was 92 or 93 yesterday and really humid. And so I need to go over and inspect some things today, but I was getting a bit concerned.
Yeah, the other thing too with the coated seed, I'll mention real quick since you brought it up, is, and you see this a lot with big box seed too, is that you're only getting 50% of the seed in your bag. So if you get a 20-pound bag, there's only 10 pounds of seed in there. There's 10 pounds of seed coating on that seed. So just remember that. And as far as rates go, what all these folks are telling you is, so a normal high seeding rate for Kentucky bluegrass is 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet. Well, they're telling you still go ahead and go at 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet. And you're going to be fine. So even though there's only half the seed going out, they still feel pretty good about it. That, again, personal experience, anecdotal, I was extremely, extremely skeptical of that. And so on that big project that we did last year, we did a couple different rates of seed ranging from 180 pounds all the way down to 90 pounds. So we did, I think it was 90, 150 and 180, or excuse me, 90, 130 and 180. So 90 and 130 are 2 and 3 pounds per 1,000 square feet, 180, closer upwards of 4. So sort of kind of looking at that strata across the board, here's the thing. It really didn't make a difference. Like there, by, you know, by the 9th, 10th, 11th week after seeding, you couldn't tell which was seeded at 90 pounds and which was seeded at 4 pounds. So, you know, there's certain areas I could tell because I knew, but again, to somebody who was walking out there, like I asked our clients to go out there and just say, hey, you know, what do you think about this area here or that area there? Oh, it all looks great. I mean, so again, just, you know, little perception that you can see it. Yeah, for sure. But from a performance standpoint, now here, 51 weeks later, like, no difference whatsoever.
How was the water managed on that?
So that actually got hydro mulched. So we seeded with a drill seeder and then covered it with hydro mulch. And so watering was very, very, very similar to what we described as far as bare ground stuff. Like, do a base water in the morning, wait until about 1-2 o'clock, maybe 2 or 3 sets, 4 to 6 minutes. So we're talking like 0.05 of an inch or so, just to keep it moist. And that was it. And then we had that stuff up in 6 days, and you could have played on it in 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was that good. So again, I'm not trying to talk smack that I'm the greatest grass grower or anything like that. But when you put all these, you know, these little things together, right, you make that plan and you execute it, things turn out pretty good. So that was what we did. It was just trying to eliminate or be able to control as many of the variables as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think one of the last things we were just going to touch on here would be the patience of what it takes to do renovations. I mean, today what I just saw was 70 mile per hour winds. The rain was coming down sideways. I looked over at my project that I was working on, and I was like, well, I'm glad I have some ryegrass in place to at least hold something there. It doesn't look too bad, but I haven't gone to see everything in person yet. But I mean, last year there were times when that exact same thing happened. I seeded the area out by the street by my house 4 times, I think. And that was bluegrass. So this spring, it still did not look very good. I had a couple comments on YouTube that were like, why are you showing that part of your lawn? It looks terrible. I'm like, well, bluegrass doesn't grow overnight.
Show the ugly. Like, yeah. I think that's, I'll opine for just one moment here and just say that, you know, to have 100% curb to curb, perfect green, 52 weeks out of the year, like, it's not realistic. So that's where you're again setting those expectations. And I think it's okay to say that, you know what, my expectations are high, and the way that turned out after the first time, the second time, the third time weren't where I needed it to be. And so it required me to do it a fourth time. And so the patience part comes in where something's gonna go wrong, and it could be major. It could be that 70 mile an hour storm let loose a torrential rain that just washed out your entire thing. And I mean, there's things that literally bring it to your knees where you're just like, man, I cannot believe that we got to this point and then this happened. Mm-hmm. Right. There's things like that happen all the time. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to feel about something, but from experience and going through, you know, these types of situations, at least professionally and not on a homeowner setting, but professionally, you learn that you got to embrace the journey, or embrace that grind of, okay, hey, here's another problem. How do we deal with this? You know? And so it's that experience that comes with, you know, you do these several times, and yet you've worked to build up both your knowledge and your experience, you know, so that you can put those two to work and continue to do better and better and better. And that's where it comes into, you know, the folks that are listening right now are probably trying to put together their own set of knowledge and experience. And I'm here to tell you that part of that process is bad stuff happening.
Yep.
And hopefully they know that from their professional endeavors, personal or whatever, that things don't always go according to plan. But if you are patient,
yep,
and work the process, then things will turn out pretty good.
I've gotten a lot better at that than I used to be. I don't know if we'll call it old age or whatever we'll call it, but I mean, I'm a pretty particular person about everything that I do. So
everybody does have a process, and I hope that, and I think your process I've seen, I hope that everybody else realizes that failure is a part of that. You're not here for the self-help college lecture series right now, but man, this stuff is like, you know, it gets deeply emotional when it's about your lawn or your home or your landscape or something like that. And especially when it's your livelihood, like me, you know, you take the failures personally, and it's, you got to learn to not do that. So, but in any event, I think just stay in the course and being patient. That's the key to really being successful.
Yep. I agree. Well, I think we covered, again, quite a plethora today of a whole bunch of stuff. And I hope that it was somewhat entertaining at the same time. But Ryan, thank you for all of your conversation.
hey, yeah, we did cover a lot, and hopefully we can talk more about some of these deeper dive topics in the future. But it was good to catch up on some of these questions from loyal listeners thus far. We really appreciate the support.
Well, enjoy the rest of your day. I'm going to go survey the damage outside and get some good footage, hopefully.
Yes. Well, you're one of those guys, right?
Yep.
Awesome. All right. Well, don't be the storm chaser. Just be the storm follower. Okay, Ryan,
exactly.
We need you here.
Exactly.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, hey, have a great day, and we'll talk soon.
Later.
See ya.